I'm Gary Shapiro. Welcome to the From the Bookshelf podcast. This week, my guest is novelist Megan Abbott. Megan Abbott is the author of several cool mysteries of the noir variety, The End of Everything, The Fever, Dare Me, to name a few. And her latest is the chilling You Will Know Me, a story set in the world of girls' gymnastics. Megan Abbott, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Did you make a decision as a writer that you would write this type of novel, or did this sort of just come to you naturally?
It crept in. You know, I'd always loved film noir growing up. I loved old movies. I loved, you know, Double Indemnity, The Big Sleep, and all. Just a lover of that genre. And I was always interested in books about, you know, human psychology and suspense and Shirley Jackson, you know. So when I started writing, it was trying to write my way into those worlds somehow, I think.
Because those are the coolest.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone looks great too.
Yeah. Well, as you're walking around, you know, in the world, do you basically think people are creepy, that the person sitting next to you is potentially a murderer?
No, you know, it's funny. People often ask me that, and you know, to me, I don't know. Once I've become interested in something or somebody, I no longer think of them that creepy way. You know, I try to, you know, sort of dig past that, and so I think it's. I think I've always been drawn to the outsider or the outlaw or, you know, those of us who don't quite fit in. So I think it comes rather naturally to me, which I guess makes it easier walking alone at night somehow.
Well, you know, you mentioned Double Indemnity, and in the movie, you never really know about Barbara Stanwyck's character, if she's telling the truth or lying, whether she really loves Neff or not.
Exactly. She has this sort of cool mask throughout, and it's so much from the point of view of Walter, and, you know, he can't really access her. And I think that's one of the fascinations of noir. I think, you know, we're always really grounded in one person's perspective and their sort of paranoid view of the world. So the woman in those books and movies is often the other, sort of mysterious and unknowable.
And is that something that you have striven for, strove? What's the word?
Yeah, either one. I guess I always, you know, noir in particular and crime fiction in general has always been a little bit male-dominated. And I've always tried to go behind the mask of the femme fatale, who would be considered the femme fatale, and try to find her corners and, you know, and her motives and look at it from her point of view. So it's a little bit of both for me, I think. I think I have maybe some dangerous men in my book, books who we can't access, but I've tried to sort of, in some ways, make it less of the woman always as the other.
Well, what kind of little girl were you?
I definitely liked creepy stories, that's for sure. I always liked Poe, and I always liked ghost stories. But my parents were big readers, and they just sort of encouraged me to read whatever I wanted, which is, you know, which was a great freedom. And I think I just always was sort of loved to sort of, you know, go into the attic, so to speak, the books that, you know, felt like they were going to offer up secrets somehow.
Well, you know, I don't know what we can say about You Will Know Me that won't give too much away. You were on Entertainment Weekly's Must List. That must have been nice. And you got a nice review in the New York Times Book Review, which was also great. And I noticed that they used the exact same picture. I guess there's only one picture of the mysterious Megan.
That's right. It's really an author who avoids, you know, getting the author photo taken again.
But do you think that the reviews give away too much of your story the way movie previews do?
Possibly. I mean, what I always hope is that, you know, I always try to satisfy the reader that wants the twists and turns and, you know, wants to be surprised, but also satisfy the reader who I think I've always been more like, where it's not always the sort of central question answered, you know, who did this thing, but that there's other questions that are pursued in the book. And for me, with You Will Know Me, for instance, it's really about the mysteries of family. In this case, you know, the parent, what a marriage is like when you're parents to a prodigy, and, you know, when, how, you know, the sort of weight of power and love in a family when there's a very special child. So I always hope that, you know, that it isn't always just a matter of who, but the why.
Your new book, You Will Know Me, is set in the world of girls' gymnastics, a world that we've just been obsessed with during the Summer Olympics. And, gosh, you know, there's just something unsettling about girls' gymnastics, do you think?
I do, and I love it, and I so admire gymnasts, but there is, of course, like with a lot of sport, anything you excel at, it can veer, the intensity of it can push it into another place. And with gymnastics, you're sort of, now girls start it so young, sometimes as early as 3 or 4 years old, and if they're very good, they're essentially shaping their body to match the form that's best in terms of physics, you know, the laws of physics, so they can become essentially this this sort of bullet or missile. So it can really change the way their body's developed. These large shoulders, but they don't necessarily go through puberty when the other girls do. And so all of that I found pretty fascinating. And there were definitely corners of it that seemed quite dark and complicated.
And, you know, one of the darkest and most complicated aspects, I would think, is the sort of sexual objectification of it. That is, you've got girls who are little, it's kind of like the beauty pageant thing. Their bodies are very exposed, and in a very, you know, when I was a kid, I was found it baffling that particular kind of, like, people who were ice skating or doing ballet could wear those kinds of clothes and it was totally okay, whereas if a stripper is wearing them, then it's nasty.
Right, exactly. And sometimes some of the moves, particularly with floor routines with gymnasts, sort of echo. There's a little bit of, you know, occasionally, not necessarily at the Olympic level, but at the lower levels, they sort of echo some of, you know, sort of not a striptease, but a little bit of the moves of,
the
you
pole
know.
Dance.
Yeah, and it is quite alarming. They're wearing very skimpy outfits, obviously. And in some way, you know, really for practical purposes, they're wearing it to, you know, to have as little wind resistance as possible and to show their muscles to the judges. But of course, there are these other, you know, there's these other sort of elements to it that it's hard to ignore, because we're really obviously much more careful about that as a culture right now. So I do think it occupies a slightly queasy space, which probably says more about all of us than about anything to do with gymnastics, but it's there nonetheless.
Is that one of the things, is that the thing that drew you to center a story there?
It certainly was a piece of it. It seemed rather complex. You know, just this week there were stories breaking about, you know, coaches, and this isn't a factor in my book, but, coaches being inappropriate with gymnasts and all of it seems really, you know, the sort of vulnerability of these young women and all these, you know, adults who are sort of depending on them and perhaps taking advantage of them. It is sort of possibility of it to be a predatory situation. So that all seemed interesting. And in this case of my book, you know, the parents are very protective, obviously, as all parents, I think, are, but it's certainly something that they think about. It's hard not to, you know, we don't live in that more innocent time when, of course, the stuff was going on, but we just weren't so hyper aware of it.
Megan Abbott, do you, as a writer, do you use readers' expectations? Oh, you know, readers are going to think this, and is that something you think about when you're writing?
Yeah, all the time, you know, and you can only, you know, you can't, you know, I never wanted to be one of those writers that, you know, when you're reading it, you feel manipulated. Always wanted to strike a balance, but I do like, you know, going back to Double Indemnity, I love those old noir films and novels where it felt like, the protagonist was kind of whispering in your ear, you know, confiding things in you that may or may not be accurate because they're just their point of view. And I like playing with that a lot, so that there's like an intimate relationship between the book and the reader. Those are always my favorite books where I felt like, the author or the character or the book itself was sort of summoning me, you know, crooking the finger and drawing me closer.
Yeah, well, of course, the books of James M. Cain, who wrote Double Indemnity,
right,
they're different because they're usually told in the voice of the person who's doing it. And therefore, you kind of are sort of swept along like, oh, this horrible thing that this person is doing makes perfect sense. I
That's
guess
right. There's a complicity, for sure. And I do think about that with all my main characters. In this book, you know, the main character, whom I really like, but she, you know, her Katie, she could be considered a stage mom or a helicopter parent or, you know, an overly invested, at least, mom. But I wanted to show, you know, that they, you know, from the, you know, from the outside she may appear this, but there's more going on with her, you know, which, of course, if then we follow her as a reader, then, you know, we have to follow her everywhere she goes.
And everywhere she goes in her thoughts as well.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I think that that's really one of the reasons that most of us read. You know, we want to go places we haven't been before, even if it sometimes makes us uncomfortable.
Do you think that that, you know, serves a purpose in terms of crime? That is, if someone reads a crime novel, then they're less likely to commit a crime? Or does it work the other way? Oh, you know, this would be a, I could actually murder my...
My fear is that, yeah, no, I don't, you know, there's no instructions. but certainly, I mean, I think one of the reasons that crime fiction is sort of always there and is always popular is it sort of is this, it lets us exorcise, you know, EXO, exorcise some of our own demons, you know. We can see it played out in book forms through different feelings of anger or feelings of betrayal or desire, and we can read on the page and then we're kind of free of it when we're done. You know, it may leave a few marks if the book really, you know, hit us, you know, close to home, but I think it sort of becomes an outlet so that, you know, we feel in some way a kind of release when it's over.
Well, let us in a little bit on the magic. When you are writing a book like You Will Know Me, do you have the ending in mind and then you kind of wrap the story around it like an onion, or do you start writing a story and see where it goes?
I do generally have the very ending in mind, not necessarily the specifics of it, but I know where I want to be, but it's in pretty general terms, and then I really, it's not until I find the voice of the main character that I really know how I'm going to get there and how to sort of build the book. It kind of, you know, having been raised on movies, I don't outline, but I tend to have like a 3-act structure, like a movie in my head, and I know what the last act is, and I sort of, you know, figure out the first 2 acts, and then I'm trying to work my way to it somehow. Occasionally it changes the very ending, but mostly it doesn't. Mostly it's the other things along the way that change a lot.
Does it ever happen that your characters say or do things that surprise you?
Yes, that's my favorite part of writing. It's so creepy. It's this oddest feeling, or they'll take over. There's a character, and You Will Know Me, the little brother, who was meant to be a minor character, but I liked him so much that he sort of started to take a bigger and bigger role. And I've written one book where I was meant to kill off a character that I liked a lot, so I ended up keeping her alive for the whole book because I liked her. And it was sort of like they exert their will, the characters, at a certain point.
Don't kill me.
Yes, exactly. You can't do it. I'm too important to you.
In case you want to write a sequel about me.
That's right.
Well, so have you always had a jillion stories rattling around in your head, or do you sit down with a blank slate and think, what am I going to do next?
I often have a few that, you know, I'll have ideas and I just don't quite know what the book itself would be. They're just sort of, you know, for this one I had thought about stage mothers, but I didn't know what the book would be. And I've had other books like that where there's certain character dynamic that I'm interested in, but I, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And then, so it sort of goes in the drawer, so to speak, until somehow it comes to me. So I like to have a few like that. And often I've had false starts. I've gotten as far as 80 or 100 pages into a manuscript and had to dump it, which is an awful feeling. But I always tell myself that I had to do it. For, you know, I got something out of it.
It was a learning process. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
In the golden age of cinema that we've been talking about, because the production code was there, people in the film noir always had to have... They always had to have something bad. They couldn't get away with it. They had to get caught. Walter, you're washed up, right?
Right, exactly.
But you're sort of free of that. You don't have a production code when you write.
Yes, you know, and I often think that, you know, the production code gets a bad rap because it made for some great movies, though, because they had to figure out other ways to get their point across, you know, because in the end they had to punish the criminal, which sort of can be a drag, I suppose, you know, but the films ended up being quite subversive in other ways, and in some ways that's an element that I like to hold on to, you know. I don't necessarily have to put, you know, the criminals in my books in prison at the end, but they really make their own prisons ultimately, I think, and that becomes interesting to think about. So then, you know, you have a relationship with the reader that's a little different than in film. It's a little more intense. You know, it's a little closer. So I think in that way, that's a sort of plus in terms of engaging them and taking them sort of down these corners and letting them, in some ways, provide the twist to the subversion, because readers' minds, you know, will always come up with anything, you know, something better than you ever would have thought of.
I don't think so.
Sometimes. Always surprised. You know, you think you wrote one kind of book, and then you go, like, now I'm on book tour, and I have these, some people have already read the book, and I'm always surprised at their theories or their ideas about the characters or their, you know, things that they think they caught that they thought I meant that were just accidents.
Oh, but do you think that a writer, even a writer like Megan Abbott, might put things in a book that they didn't know they put in?
I do think there's a piece of it, and not to sort of be overly woo-woo about it, but I do think there's a part of it that's it's unconscious. You know, there's often, someone told me recently that I always have a character with a tattoo or a scar on all my books, and I was completely unaware of this, and I don't have a tattoo or a significant scar, but for some reason it just seems to land there, and I was unaware of it till he told me. And you know, so I think there's, you know, it just comes out, you know, it just comes out somehow, in some kind of Freudian way. You know, it's the return of the repressed, I guess. I think it emerges even if we aren't aware, especially if we aren't aware of it. Otherwise, I would try to stop myself so I don't repeat.
Well, neither your scar or your tattoo are visible in the one photograph.
That's right. I hide it well.
I think you've hired someone to portray Megan Abbott in the photo.
That's right. Well, I would have made her taller, though.
You can't tell because it's just a little picture.
That's true. There's no scale.
So what are some of the other authors that have influenced you? What about Patricia Highsmith? Does she play a...
Yeah, she was huge for me. I started reading her, I was about a teenager, I guess, when I started reading her. My mom was a big fan of hers, and my dad. So she was definitely, she felt like, you know, she would do anything. There was a kind of ferocity to her writing that thrilled me. And same with Shirley Jackson. And then, you know, a lot of the big male crime writers, like James Ellroy, was very significant to me, you know, so much in the world of L.A., so it really connected to my love of movies. So they were really, really big. And that led me to Raymond Chandler and James M. Cain. You know, but and then outside of crime too, I've always loved, I studied American literature, so always Faulkner and Fitzgerald were big for me. Their play with language, which I love, and of course you could argue that Great Gatsby is a crime novel. So
absolutely, it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about Hammett?
Hammett for sure. In fact, you know, he's the one that sort of, in some ways, feels like the most magical. His prose is just, you know, it's like a steel trap. So he's really big for me. And just, you know, he's just one with a dialogue. It's just that rat-a-tat-tat dialogue that you just, you know, I wish people talked like that, you know.
Well, they do in his books.
So. That's right, exactly.
It feels real.
It does.
I know, I wonder if he and Lillian Hellman, you know, talked like Nick and Nora Chung.
Yeah, because she was a pretty tough broad, you know. I think I would have loved to eavesdrop on their conversations.
Do you think that you would consider at some stage in your career writing a book with no crime or a science fiction story or something like that?
Yeah, I really don't. I think about this a lot because I've been doing some other kinds of writing, some TV and things like that, and I can't seem to, it's so fundamental to story to me, but I don't write whodunits, which I love to read, but for some reason, crime has always been a piece of it. Now, I've written things where there isn't a death. I've written things where it's, you know, a heist or a kidnapping, but for some reason that's just fundamental to my idea of story or plot. So I never say never, but it would be hard for it to, like, what would the story be?
There was no crime.
That's right. Maybe a ghost. Maybe for a ghost. Maybe, you know, I always did love ghost stories, and a good ghost story is maybe the hardest thing to write of all, because there, you know, it's been done so exquisitely.
Hitchcock never did a whodunit, or rarely did a whodunit.
That's right. He was always more interested in sort of, you know, psychology and sort of human perversity in the heist. I think that's why he and Highsmith made such a good match.
Yeah. Well, this is a fabulous book, and we didn't talk too much about it because I don't want to... It seemed to me that any question that I wanted to ask you would have spoiled it. But maybe after everyone in the world has read it, he'll come back and talk to me some more.
I would love to.
The book is called... You Will Know Me. That's a creepy title. The creepy writer who wrote it is my guest, Megan Abbott. Thank you so much for spending some time here on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed this podcast, and we'll come back and listen to us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Megan Abbott. Her new book is called You Will Know Me, and it's really great. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. You can hear this show live every Monday night at 7 on KSCO in Santa Cruz. And you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening. See you next time.